to go.
How could she convey to him how wrong he was? How could she let him know that he was, in all ways, the finest man she had known, and that the few months she had spent without him had made every day feel like the bleakest winter? How could she tell him that even now, 10 years in, him simply resting a hand on her waist made something buck and spark inside her? She got up from the table and placed her arms around his neck, her seat upon his lap. She rested her cheek against his so that her words were murmured in his ear.
I will never, ever tell you to go. There is no chance of that happening, Mr. Gustafson. I will be with you day and night for as long as you can stand me. And you know I never say anything I don't mean.
He was late to work, of course. He struggled to feel bad about it all day. A holly wreath, a cornhusk doll, a pot of preserved fruit, or a bracelet of polished stone. As Christmas drew closer, the girls would return each day with small thank you gifts from the homes they visited. They pooled them at the library building, agreeing that something should be given to Fred Geisler for his support over the past 6 months, but that bracelets and dollies were probably a little wide of the mark. Marjorie suspected there was only one gift that would make him happy, and that was something he was unlikely to put on his Christmas list. Alice's life now seemed to revolve around the library. She was fiercely efficient, had memorized every route from Baileyville to Jeffersonville, never balking at any extra mileage that Marjorie threw her way. She was the first to arrive each morning, striding down the dark, frost-covered road, and the last to leave at night, determinedly stitching books that Sophia would unpick and redo after she had gone. She had grown wiry, muscles newly visible in her arms, her skin weathered by long days exposed to the elements, and her face was set so that her lovely smile rarely lit her features, but flashed up only when it was required, and rarely stretched as far as her eyes.
"That girl is the saddest thing I ever saw," Sophia remarked as Alice brought her saddle in and went straight back out into the dark to give Spirit a rub down. "Something ain't right in that house."
She shook her head as she sucked a piece of cotton, ready to rethread her needle.
"I used to think Bennett Van Cleve was the greatest catch in Baileyville," said Izzy. "But I watched him walking with Alice from church the other day, and he acts like she's got chiggers. Wouldn't even take her arm."
"He's a pig," said Beth. "And that damn Peggy Foreman is always strolling past him in her finest, with her girls, trying to catch his eye."
"Shh," said Marjorie, evenly. "No need for gossip. Alice is our friend."
"I meant it nicely," Izzy protested.
"Doesn't stop it being gossip," Marjorie said.
She glanced at Fred, who was focused intently on framing 3 maps of the new routes they had taken on that week. He often stayed late, finding excuses to walk down and fix things that didn't really need fixing long after he had finished with his horses, stacking up logs for the burner, or blocking drafts with rags. It didn't take a genius to work out why.
"How you doing, Kathleen?"
Kathleen Bly wiped her forehead and tried to raise a smile.
"Oh, you know, getting by."
There was a peculiar weighted quality to the silence left by Garrett Bly's absence. On the table, there was a selection of filled bowls and baskets, food gifts left by neighbors, and some mourning cards stood on the mantel. Outside the back door, 2 hens ruffled their feathers on a large stack of firewood that had arrived, unheralded, overnight. Further up the slope, the newly carved gravestone stood bleached white against its neighbors. People of the mountain, whatever anyone said about them, knew how to look after their own. So the cabin was warm and food ready to be eaten, but the interior was still, motes floating in the undisturbed air, and the children lay motionless in the cot, their arms thrust across each other in afternoon sleep, as if the whole domestic tableau were suspended in time.
"I brought you some magazines. I know you couldn't face reading the last few, but I thought maybe some short stories, or something for the children."
"You're very kind," said Kathleen.
Alice stole a look at her, She didn't know what to do, faced with the enormity of the woman's loss. It was etched across Kathleen's face, in her downturned eyes, and the new lines around her mouth, visible in the effort it seemed to take her just to move her hand across her brow. She looked almost unbearably weary, as if she just wanted to lie down and sleep for a million years.
"Did you want a drink?" Kathleen said abruptly, as if remembering herself. She glanced behind her. "I think I have some coffee. Should still be warm. I'm sure I made some this morning."
"I'm fine. Thank you."
They sat in the little room, and Kathleen pulled her shawl around her. Outside, the mountain was silent, the trees bare, and the gray sky hung low over the spindly branches. A solitary crow broke the stillness, its harsh, abrasive cry rising above the mountaintop. Spirit, tied to the fence post, stamped a foot, steam rising from her nostrils. Alice pulled the books from her saddlebag.
"I know little Pete loves the rabbit stories, and this one is new, in from the publishing house itself. But I've earmarked some Bible readings in this one that you might take comfort in, if you really didn't want to read anything longer. And there's some poetry. Have you heard of George Herbert? Those can be good to dip into. I've been reading quite a bit of poetry myself lately."
She placed the books neatly on the table.
"And you can keep these until the new year."
Kathleen regarded the little pile for a moment. She reached out a finger and traced the title of the book on the top. Then she withdrew it.
"Miss Alice, you may as well take these back with you."
She pushed her hair back from her face.
"I wouldn't want to waste them. I know how desperate everyone is for reading, and that's a long wait for some."
"It's no trouble."
Kathleen's smile wavered.
"In fact, I can't see how it's worth you wasting your time coming all the way up here just now. To tell you the truth, I can't hold a thought in my head, and the children, well, I don't seem to have much time or energy to read to them either."
"Don't you worry. There are plenty of books and magazines to go round. And I'll just leave picture books for the children. You won't need to do anything, and they can..."
I can't seem to fix on much. I can't do anything. I get up each day, and I get through my chores, and I feed the children and mind the animals, but it all seems..."
Her smile broke. Kathleen lowered her face into her hands and let out an audible, shaky sigh. A moment passed. Her shoulders began to convulse silently, and just as Alice was wondering what to say, a low, broken howl emerged from somewhere deep within Kathleen, raw and animal. It was the most painful sound Alice had ever heard. It rose and fell on a tide of grief and seemed to come from some place completely broken.
"I miss him."
Kathleen wept, her hands pressed tightly to her face.
"I just miss him. I miss him so much. I miss the feel of him and the touch of him, and I miss his hair, and I miss the way he used to say my name, and I know he was sick for so long, and that by the end he was barely a shell of himself, but oh, Lord, how am I meant to go on without him? Oh, God, I can't do it. I just can't. Oh, Miss Alice, I want my Garrett back. I just want him back."
It was doubly shocking, because, outside anger, Alice had never seen any of the local families express greater emotion than either mild disapproval or amusement. Mountain people were stoic, not given to unexpected shows of vulnerability, which made this somehow even more unbearable. Alice leaned forward and took Kathleen in her arms, the young woman's body racked with sobs so fierce that Alice's own body shook with them. She placed her arms tightly around her, pulled her close, and let her cry, holding her so tightly that the sadness seeping out of Kathleen became an almost tangible thing, the grief she carried a weight that settled over them both. She pressed her head to Kathleen's, trying to lift a little of the sadness to tell her silently that there was still beauty in this world, even if some days it took every bit of strength and obstinacy to find it. Eventually, like a wave crashing onto the shore, Kathleen's sobs slowed and quieted into sniffs and hiccups, leaving her to shake her head with embarrassment and wipe at her eyes.
I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm so sorry.
Don't be,
Alice whispered back.
Please don't be sorry.
She took Kathleen's hands in her own.
It's wonderful that you got to love somebody that much.
Kathleen raised her head then, and her swollen, red-rimmed eyes searched Alice's. She squeezed Alice's hands. Both were roughened from work, thin and strong.
I'm sorry,
she said again, and this time Alice understood that she meant something quite different. She held the woman's gaze until Kathleen finally released her hand and swiped at her tears with her flat palm, glancing over at the still sleeping children.
My goodness, you'd best be getting on, she said. You got rounds to get through. Lord knows the weather's closing in, and I'd better wake those babies or they'll have me up half the night again.
Alice didn't move.
Kathleen?
Yes?
That desperate, bright smile again, wavering and yet determined. It seemed to take all the effort in the world. Alice lifted the books onto her lap.
Would you like me to read to you? For everything, there is a season, and a time for every matter under the heaven, a time to be born, and a time to die, a time to plant, and a time to pluck up that which is planted, a time to kill, and a time to heal, a time to break down, and a time to build up, a time to weep, and a time to laugh, a time to mourn, and a time to dance.
Two women sat in a tiny cabin on the side of a vast mountain as the sky slowly darkened, and inside the lamps sent out slivers of gold light through the gaps in the wide oak planks. One read, her voice quiet and precise, and the other sat, her stockinged feet tucked up under her on the chair, her head resting against her open palm, lost in her thoughts. Time passed slowly. And neither of them minded, and the children, when they stirred awake, didn't cry, but sat quietly and listened, even though they understood barely any of what was said. An hour later, the two women stood at the door, and, almost on an impulse, hugged each other tightly. They wished each other a happy Christmas, and both smiled wryly, knowing that for each this year it would simply have to be endured.
Better days, said Kathleen.
Yes,
Alice responded.
Better days.
And with this thought, she wrapped her scarf high around her neck so that it covered everything but her eyes, mounted the little brown and white horse, and made her way back toward the town. Perhaps it was boredom at being stuck in the house after years of long days spent in the camaraderie of other miners, but William liked Sophia to tell him what had been happening at the library each day. He knew all about Marjorie's anonymous letters to the families of Northridge, who had asked for which books at the cabin, about Mr. Frederick's deepening crush on Miss Alice, and the way she herself seemed to be hardening, like ice creeping across water, as that fool Bennett Van Cleve gave her the cold shoulder and killed her love for him inch by frozen inch.
You think he's one of them?
William asked.
Men that like other men?
Who knows? Far as I can see, that boy don't love nothing but his own reflection. Wouldn't surprise me if he stands in front of the mirror and kisses the glass every day instead of his wife,
she retorted, and enjoyed the rare sight of her brother bent double with laughter. But she was darned if she could find much to tell him today. Alice had sat down heavily on the little cane chair in the corner, and her shoulders had slumped like she was carrying the weight of the world. Tiredness doesn't make you look like that. When they were physically tired, the girls would pull off their boots and bitch and moan and rub at their eyes and laugh at each other. Alice just sat there, still as a stone, her thoughts somewhere far from the little cabin. Fred saw it. Sophia saw he was pretty much itching to walk over there and comfort her, but instead he just went to his coffee jug and brewed her a fresh mug, placing it in front of her so gently that it took her a moment even to register that he had done it. Your heart would break to see how tender he looked at her. You okay, girl? Sophia said quietly when Fred had stepped out for more logs. She didn't speak for a moment, then wiped at her eyes with the heel of her palms.
I'm fine, Sophia. Thank you.
She looked over her shoulder at the door.
Plenty worse off than me, right?
She said it like it was something she'd repeated to herself many times. She said it like she was trying to convince herself of it.
Ain't that always the truth? Sophia responded.
But then there was Marjorie. She'd blown in like a whirlwind as dusk fell, her eyes wild, her coat dusted with snow, and a strange, brittle energy about her so that she forgot to close the door, and Sophia had to scold her to remind her that it was still blizzarding outside, and was she actually born in a barn? Anyone been by here? She said. The girl's face was as white as if she'd seen a haint.
Who you expecting?
Nobody, she said quickly.
Her hands were trembling, but it wasn't from cold. Sophia put down her book.
You okay, Miss Marjorie? You don't seem yourself.
I'm fine, I'm fine.
She peered out of the door like she was waiting for something. Sophia eyed her bag.
You want to give me those books so I can enter them?
Marjorie didn't answer, her attention still fixed on the door, so Sophia got up and pulled them out herself, placing them on the desk one by one.
Mac McGuire and the Indian Chief, weren't you taking this to the Stone Sisters up on Arnott's Ridge?
Marjorie's head spun round.
What? Oh, yes, I'll take them tomorrow.
Ridge not passable?
No.
Then how are you going to get up there tomorrow? It's still snowing.
Marjorie seemed temporarily lost for words.
I'll work it out.
Where's Little Women? You signed that out too, remember?
She was behaving real strange. And then, she told William, Mr. Frederick came in, and it got really odd.
Fred, you got any spare guns?
He put a basket of logs down by the burner.
Guns? What you want guns for, Marge?
I thought maybe it would be good for the girls to learn to shoot, to take a firearm on the remote routes, in case.
She blinked twice.
Of snakes?
In winter?
The bears, then.
Hibernating. Besides, no one's seen a bear in these mountains for 5-10 years. You know that as well as I do.
Sophia looked incredulous.
You think Mrs. Brady's gonna let her little girl carry a gun? You're meant to be carrying books, Marge, not guns. You think some family who don't trust you girls anyway is gonna trust you more if you turn up at their house with a hunting rifle strapped to your back?
Fred was frowning at her. He and Sophia exchanged a bemused look. Marjorie appeared to snap out of whatever weird funk she was in.
You're right. You're right. Don't know what I was thinking.
She raised an unconvincing smile. But here was the thing, Sophia told William as they sat at the little table eating supper. 2 days later, when Marjorie returned, Sophia picked up her saddlebag to unpack it while Marjorie stepped out to use the water closet. The days were cold and hard, and she liked to help the girls whichever way she could. She took out the last of the books, then nearly dropped the canvas bag in fright. At the bottom, neatly wrapped in a red handkerchief, she could just make out the bone grip of a Colt 45 pistol.
Bob told me you were waiting out here. I wondered why you canceled on me last night.
Sven Gustafsson emerged from the gates of the mine, still in his work overalls, but with his thick flannel jacket over the top and his hands thrust deep into his pockets. He walked up to the mule and stroked his neck, letting Charlie's soft nose nuzzle his pockets for treats.
Get a better offer, did you?
He smiled and placed his hand on Marjorie's leg. She flinched. He removed it, his smile vanishing.
You okay?
Can you come to mine when you're done?
He studied her face.
Sure, but I thought we weren't seeing each other till Friday.
Please.
She never said please. Despite the freezing temperatures, he found her on the rocking chair on the stoop, her rifle across her legs in the dark, the light of the little oil lamp flickering across her face. She was rigid, her eyes trained on the horizon, her jaw set. Bluey sat at her feet, glancing up at her from minute to minute, as if her anxiety had rubbed off on him, and shaking in short bursts from the cold.
"What's going on, Marge?"
"I think Clem McCullough is coming after me."
Sven walked up to her. There was something absent and watchful in the way she spoke, as if she barely registered him being there. Her teeth chattered.
"Marge?"
He went to place his hand on her knee, but remembering her reaction of earlier, he touched the back of her hand lightly instead. She was frozen.
"Marge, it's too cold to sit out here. You gotta come inside.
I need to be ready for him.
The dog will let us know if anyone's coming.
Come on, what happened?"
She stood finally and allowed him to steer her in. The cabin was freezing, and he wondered if she'd been inside at all. He lit the stove and brought in some more logs as she stood by the window looking out. Then he fed Bluey and boiled some water.
"You stayed up all last night like that?"
"Didn't sleep a wink."
Finally, he sat down beside her and handed her a bowl of soup. She looked at it as if she didn't want it, but then drank it in short, greedy bursts, and when she'd finished, she told him the story of her ride to Red Lick, her voice uncharacteristically halting, her knuckles white and trembling, as if even now she could feel McCullough's grip still on her, his hot breath on her skin. And Sven Gustafsson, a man renowned for his unusually level temperament in a town full of hotheads, a man who would break up a bar fight 19 times out of 20 where another would be unable to resist the satisfaction of the hurled punch, found that he was possessed of an uncharacteristic rage, a red mist that descended and made him want to seek out McCullough and deliver some of his own brand of vengeance, a vengeance that involved blood and fists and busted teeth. None of this showed in his face or in the calm of his voice when he spoke again.
"You're exhausted. Go to bed."
She looked up at him.
"You're not coming?"
"Nope. I'll be out here while you sleep."
Marjorie O'Hare was not a woman who liked to depend on anyone. It was a measure of how shaken she was, he realized, that she thanked him quietly and took herself to bed without a word of protest. Chapter 11. Fair Oaks was built about 1845 by Dr. Guilford D. Runyon, a Shaker who renounced his vow of celibacy and erected the house in anticipation of his marriage to Miss Kate Farrell, who died before the house was completed. Dr. Runyon remained a bachelor until his death in 1873. WPA, the WPA Guide to Kentucky. There were 15 dolls on the dresser. They sat shoulder to shoulder like a mismatched family, their porcelain faces pale and rosy, and their real hair, where had it come from? Alice shuddered, curled into immaculate, glossy ringlets. They were the first thing Alice saw when she woke up in the morning on the little daybed, their blank faces watching her impassively, their cherry-colored lips curled into faint, disdainful smiles, frothy white pantalettes peeking out from under full Victorian skirts. Mrs. Van Cleve had loved her dolls, like she had loved her little stuffed bears and her tiny china ornaments and her porcelain snuff boxes and her carefully embroidered psalms that hung around the house, each the result of hours of intricate needlecraft. Every day, Alice was reminded of a life that had been almost solely focused on the inside of these walls, on tiny, meaningless tasks, tasks Alice felt increasingly strongly that no adult woman should view as the sum total of her day's activities. Dolls, embroidery, the dusting and precise rearranging of totems that no man noticed anyway. Until she had gone, after which they had become a shrine to a woman they now insisted they idolized. She hated those dolls, like she hated the heavy silence in the air, the endless stasis of a house in which nothing could move forward and nothing could change. She might as well be one of those dolls, she thought, as she walked through the bedroom, smiling, immobile, decorative, and silent. She glanced down at the picture of Dolores Van Cleve that sat in a large gilt frame on Bennett's bedside table. The woman held a small wooden cross between two plump hands and an expression of pained disapproval, which to Alice seemed to settle on the two of them whenever they were alone together.
"Perhaps we could move your mother a little further away, just at night," she adventured when she had first been shown their room.
But Bennett had frowned, as disbelieving as if she had cheerfully suggested digging up his mother's grave. She snapped out of her thoughts, gasping quietly as she splashed the icy water on her face and hurried into her many layers. The librarians were writing a half day today to allow them all some time for Christmas shopping, and a small part of her had to fight her disappointment at the prospect of time away from her roots. She would see Jim Horner's girls this morning. That helped. The way they would wait at the window for the sight of Spirit making her way up the track, then bolt through the wooden door, bouncing on tiptoe until she climbed off the horse, their voices bubbling over each other as they clamored to find out what she had with her, where she had been, whether she would stay for a little while longer than the last time. The way they would hang casually around her neck while she read to them, little fingers stroking her hair or planting kisses on her cheeks as if, despite the slow recovery of the little family, they were both desperate for feminine contact in some way they could barely understand. And Jim, his expression no longer hard and suspicious, would place a mug of coffee at her side, then use the time she was there to chop wood or sometimes, now, just sit and watch, as if he took pleasure in the sight of his girl's happiness as they showed off what they had learned to read that week. And they were smart. Their reading was way ahead of other children's, thanks to lessons with Mrs. Bydecker. No, the Horner girls were consolation indeed. It was just a shame that girls like them would have so little in the way of Christmas gifts. Alice wrapped her scarf around her neck and pulled on her riding gloves, wondering briefly whether to put on an extra pair of socks for the ride up the mountain. All the librarians had chilblains now, their toes pink and swollen from the cold, their fingers frequently corpse white from lack of blood. She looked out of the window at the chill gray sky. She no longer checked her reflection in the mirror. She pulled the envelope from the side, where it had sat since the previous day, and tucked it into her bag. She would read it later, once she'd done her rounds. No point getting worked up when you had 2 silent hours on a horse facing you. She looked at the dresser as she made to leave. The dolls were still staring at her. "What?" she said. But this time, they seemed to be saying something quite different.
"For us?"
Millie's mouth had dropped so far open, Alice could almost hear Sophia warning that bugs would fly straight in. She handed the other doll to May, its petticoats rustling as it was pulled swiftly into the child's lap.
"One each. We had a little chat this morning, and they told me in confidence that they'd be much happier here with you than where they've been living."
The two girls gawped at the angelic porcelain faces, and then, in unison, their heads turned toward their father. Jim Horner's own expression was unreadable.
"They're not new, Mr. Horner," Alice said carefully. "But where they come from has no real use for them. It's a house of men. It didn't seem right to have them sitting there."
She could see his indecision, the "I don't know" forming on his lips. The air in the cabin seemed to still as the girls held their breath.
"Please, Pa?"
May's voice emerged as a whisper. They sat cross-legged, and Millie's hand absently stroked the shiny chestnut curls, letting each one spring back into place, her gaze flickering from the painted face to her father's. The dolls, having for months seemed sinister, rebuking, were suddenly benign, joyful things, because they were in the place they were meant to be,
They're awful fancy, he said finally.
Well, I believe all girls deserve something a little fancy in their lives, Mr. Horner.
He rubbed a rough hand over the top of his head and looked away. May's face lengthened, fearful of what he was about to say. He motioned toward the door.
Would you mind stepping outside with me a moment, Mrs. Van Cleve?
She heard sighs of dismay from the girls as she followed him to the back of the cabin, her arms wrapped around her to keep out the cold, mentally running over the various arguments she would employ to try to change his mind. All little girls need a doll. They would likely be thrown away if the girls didn't take them. Oh, for goodness sake, why must your wretched pride get in the way of a...
What do you think?
Alice stopped in her tracks. Jim Horner lifted a piece of Hessian sacking to reveal the head of a large, somewhat threadbare stag, its antlers thrusting into the air 3 feet to each side of it, its ears stitched haphazardly to its head. It was mounted on a roughly carved oak base, which had been painted with pitch. She stifled the strangled noise that emerged unbidden from her throat.
Shot him over at Rivets Creek 2 months ago. Stuffed and mounted him myself. Got May to help me send off for them glass eyes on the mail order. They're pretty lifelike, don't you think?
Alice gaped at the deer's glassy, overlarge eyes, the left of which had a definite squint. The stag looked faintly demented and sinister, a nightmare beast conjured in fever dreams.
It's very imposing.
It's my first go. Figured I might set up a trade in them, do one every few weeks and sell them in town. Help keep us going through the winter months.
That's an idea. Maybe you could do some smaller creatures, too. A rabbit or a ground squirrel.
He mulled this over, then nodded.
So, you'll take it?
I'm sorry?
For the dolls. A trade.
Alice lifted her palms.
Oh, Mr. Horner, you really don't need to...
Can't take him for nothing.
He folded his arms firmly across his chest and waited.
What the heck is that?
Said Beth, as Alice dismounted wearily, pulling bits of foliage from the deer's antlers. It had caught on every second tree the whole way down the mountain, causing her almost to fall off several times, and now looked even more bedraggled and wonky than it had on the ridge, strung with a variety of stray twigs and leaves. She walked up the steps and placed it carefully against the wall, reminding herself, as she had now done 100 times, of the joy on the girls' faces as they learned the dolls were truly theirs, the way they cradled and sang to them, their endless thanks and kisses. The softening of the planes on Jim Horner's face as he looked on.
It's our new mascot.
Or what?
Touch a hair on its head and I'll stuff you worse than Mr. Horner stuffed that deer.
Shoot,
said Beth to Izzy as Alice strode back out to her horse.
Remember when Alice made out like she was a lady?
Lunch service had nearly finished at the White Horse Hotel, Lexington, and the restaurant had started to thin out, leaving tables scattered with the detritus of napkins and empty glasses, as, fortified, the guests wrapped themselves in scarves and hats. They were braced to venture back out onto sidewalks teeming with last-minute Christmas shoppers. Mr. Van Cleve, who had eaten well on a sirloin steak and fried potatoes, leaned back in his chair and stroked his stomach with both hands, a gesture that conveyed a satisfaction he seemed to feel less and less in other areas of his life. The girl was giving him indigestion. In any other town, such misdemeanors might eventually be forgotten, but in Baileyville, a grudge could last a century and still nurture a head of steam. The people of Baileyville were descended from Celts, from Scots and Irish families, who could hold on to resentment until it was dried out like beef jerky, and bearing no resemblance to its original self. And Mr. Van Cleve, although he was about as Celtic as the Cherokee sign on the outside of the gas station, had absorbed this trait thoroughly. More than that, he had his daddy's habit of fixing on one person then training on them his grievances and blaming them for all that ailed him. That person was Marjorie O'Hare. He rose with a curse for her on his lips, and he went to sleep with images of her taunting him. Beside him, Bennett tapped intermittently on the side of the table with his fingers. He could tell the boy wanted to be elsewhere. In truth, he didn't seem to have the focus needed for business. The other day, he had caught a gang of miners mimicking his obsession with cleanliness, pretending to rub at their blackened overalls as he passed. They straightened when they saw him watching, but the sight of his son being mocked pained him. At first, he had been almost proud of Bennett's determination to marry the English girl. He had seemed to know his own mind, finally. Dolores had cosseted the boy so, fussing over him as if he were a girl. He had stood a little taller when he informed Van Cleve that he and Alice were to be married, and, well, it was a shame about Peggy, but that was just too bad. It was good to see him hold a firm opinion for once. Now he watched the boy gradually emasculated by the English girl and her sharp tongue, her odd ways, and he regretted the day he had ever been convinced to take that damn European tour. No good ever came from mixing, not with coloreds, and, it turned out, not with Europeans neither.
"You've left crumbs here, boy."
He stabbed a fat finger on the table so that the waiter apologized and hurriedly combed them off onto a plate.
"A bourbon, Governor Hatch, to round things off? Well, if you're going to twist my arm, Jeff. Bennett? Not for me, Pa. Give me a couple of Boone County bourbons, straight up, no ice. Yes, sir. Bennett, I want you to head over to the tailor while the governor and I talk business. Ask him if he's got any more of those dress shirts, will you? I'll be there shortly."
He waited for his son to disappear from his table before he leaned forward and spoke again.
"Now, Governor, I was hoping to discuss a matter of a certain sensitivity with you." "Not more problems at the mine, Mr. Van Cleve. I hope you're not dealing with the same mess they're having down there in Harlan. You know they've got state troopers lined up to head in if they can't sort themselves out. There's machine guns and all sorts heading back and forth across state lines. Oh, you know we work hard to keep a lid on that kind of thing at Hoffman. No good can come of the unions, we know that. We've been sure to take measures to protect our mine at the very whisper of trouble. Glad to hear it. Glad to hear it. So, what seems to be the problem?"
Mr. Van Cleve leaned forward over the table.
"It's this library business."
The governor frowned.
"The women's library. Mrs. Roosevelt's initiative. These women taking books to rural families and the like. Ah, yes. Part of the WPA, I believe. The very one. Now, while I'm usually a great supporter of such enterprises, and I absolutely agree with our president and the first lady that we should be doing what we can to educate our populace, I have to say that the women, well, certain women, in our county are causing problems. Problems? This traveling library is fomenting unrest. It's encouraging all sorts of irregular behavior. For instance, Hoffman Mining was planning to explore new areas on the North Ridge, the kind of thing we've been doing entirely legitimately for decades. Now, I believe these librarians have been spreading rumors and falsehoods about it, because the next thing we've been hit with is a series of legal orders forbidding us our usual mining rights in the area. Not just one family, but a great number of them have signed up to block our path."
"That's unfortunate."
The governor lit a cigarette, offering Mr. Van Cleve the packet, which he refused.
"Indeed. If they do this with other families, we'll end up with nowhere to mine. And then what are we supposed to do? We are a major employer in this part of Kentucky. We provide a vital resource to our great nation."
"Well, Jeff, you know it doesn't take a lot to get folk up in arms about mining these days. Do you have proof it was these librarians stirring things up?"
"Well, here's the thing. Half the families now blocking us through the courts couldn't read a word last year. Where would they have got information on legal matters if it wasn't for these library books?
The bourbons arrived. The waiter lifted them from a silver tray and placed each one reverently in front of the two men.
I don't know. From what I understand, it's just a bunch of girls on horses taking recipe cards here and there. What harm are they really going to do? I think you may just have to chalk this one up to misfortune, Jeff. The amount of trouble we have around the mines just now, why, it could have been anyone.
Mr. Van Cleve felt the governor's attention starting to slide.
It's not just the mines. They are changing the very dynamics of our society. They are fixing to alter the laws of nature. The laws of nature?
When the governor looked disbelieving, he added,
There are reports of our women engaging in unnatural practices.
Now he had his attention. The governor leaned forward.
My son, God bless him. My wife and I raised him according to godly principles, so I admit he is not entirely worldly in conjugal matters. But he tells me that his young bride, who has taken up work at this library, mentioned to him a book the women are passing among them, a book of sexual content. Sexual content? Quite.
The governor took a gulp of his drink.
And, what would this sexual content comprise exactly? Well, I don't want to shock you, Governor. I won't go into details. Oh, I can take it, Jeff. Go into all the, details you like.
Mr. Van Cleve glanced behind him and lowered his voice.
He said his bride, who was by all accounts brought up like a princess from a very good family, you understand, well, she was suggesting she do things to him in the bedroom that one might expect at a French whorehouse. A French whorehouse?
The governor swallowed hard.
At first, I thought this was maybe an English thing, due to their proximity to the European ways, you know. But Bennett told me she said it was definitely from the library, spreading filth, suggestions that would make a grown man blush. I mean, where will it end? That's the, pretty blonde? The one I met last year at dinner? The very one. Alice. Finer than frog hair. The shock of hearing salaciousness proposed by a girl like that? Well.
The governor took another very long sip of his drink. His eyes had gone a little glassy.
Did he give, details of the exact activities she was proposing? Just so, you know, I can be clear on the full picture.
Mr. Van Cleve shook his head.
Poor Bennett was so shook up it took him weeks even to confide in me. Hasn't felt able to lay a finger on her since. I mean, it ain't right, Governor. Not for decent, God-fearing wives to be suggesting such deviance.
The governor appeared to be deep in thought.
Governor? Filth, right. Sorry, yes. I mean, no. Anyway, I would appreciate knowing whether other counties are having the same issues with their women in these so-called libraries. I can't believe this is a good thing for our workforce or Christian families. My inclination would be to shut the scheme down altogether. Likewise with this mining permissions business.
Mr. Van Cleve folded his napkin and laid it on the table. The governor was still apparently considering this very carefully.
Or perhaps you think the best way forward would be just to deal with the matter in whichever way we thought fit.
He wasn't sure, he told Bennett afterward, whether the governor's drink had actually gone to his head. He seemed markedly distracted toward the end of lunch.
So what did he say?
Said Bennett, who had cheered up with the purchase of some new corduroys and a striped sweater.
I told him maybe I should deal with all these matters how I liked, and he just said, yes, quite, and then said he had to leave.
Dear Alice, I am sorry married life is not as you expected. I'm not sure what you think marriage should be about, and you have not given us details of what it is you find so dispiriting, but Daddy and I wonder if we haven't given you false expectations. You have a handsome husband, financially secure, and able to offer you a good future. You have married into a decent family with significant resources. I think you need to learn to count your chickens. Life is not always about happiness. It is about duty and taking satisfaction from doing the right thing. We were hoping you had learned to be less impulsive. Well, you've made your bed, and you're just going to have to learn to stick things out. Perhaps if you have a baby, it will give you a focus, so you don't dwell on things so. If you do choose to return without your husband, I have to inform you that you will not be welcome to stay here. Your loving mother. Alice had held off opening the letter, perhaps because she had known the words she was going to find within it. She felt her jaw tighten, then folded it carefully and placed it back in her bag, noting once more as she did so that her fingernails, once highly polished and filed, were now ragged or cut down to the quick, and some small part of her wondered, as she did daily, whether that was the reason he didn't want to touch her. "Okay," said Marjorie, appearing at her shoulder. "I ordered 2 new girths and a saddle cloth from Crompton's, and I thought maybe this for Fred as a thank you. Think he'll like it?" She held up a dark green scarf. The department store assistant, transfixed by Marjorie's beaten-up leather hat and breeches — she couldn't see the point in dressing up to come to Lexington, she had told Alice, as she'd only have to get changed again when she got back — had needed a second to remember to take it from her, ready to wrap in tissue. "We'll have to hide it from Fred on the ride back."
"Sure."
Marjorie squinted at her.
"Did you even look at it?"
"What's going on, Alice?"
"Look at what?" "Oh, Lord, Bennett. I have to find something for Bennett."
Alice's hands flew to her face as she realized she no longer knew what her husband liked, let alone his collar size. She reached for a set of boxed handkerchiefs on the shelf, decorated with a sprig of holly. Were handkerchiefs too impersonal a gift for one's husband? How intimate could a gift be when you hadn't seen more than an inch of his bare skin for the best part of 6 weeks? She startled as Marjorie took her arm, steering her toward a quiet part of the men's department.
"Alice, are you okay? 'Cause you got a face on you most days like blinked milk." "There are no complaints, are there?"
Alice glanced down at the handkerchiefs. Would it be better if she had his initials embroidered on them? She tried to imagine Bennett opening them on Christmas morning. Somehow, she couldn't picture him smiling. She couldn't imagine him smiling at anything she did anymore.
"Anyway," she said, her tone defensive, "you're a fine one to talk. You've barely said a word the last couple of days."
Marjorie seemed a little taken aback and gave a shake of her head.
Just had a little upset on one of my rounds."
She swallowed.
"Rattled me a bit."
Alice thought of Kathleen Bly, the way that the young widow's grief would cast a pall over her own day.
"I understand. It's a tougher job than you think sometimes, isn't it? Not really about delivering books at all. I'm sorry if I've been miserable. I'll pull myself together."
The truth was that the prospect of Christmas made Alice want to weep. The idea of sitting at that tense table, Mr. Van Cleve glowering across from her, Bennett silent and simmering at whatever she had supposedly done wrong now. The watchful Annie, who seemed to delight in the worsening atmosphere. Derailed by this thought, it took Alice a minute to realize that Marjorie was regarding her closely.
"I'm not getting at you, Alice. I'm..."
Marjorie shrugged, as if the words were unfamiliar to her.
"I'm asking as a friend."
"A friend."
"You know me. Been content my whole life to be on my own. But this last few months, I've... Well,
I've grown to enjoy your company. I like your sense of humor. You treat people with kindness and respect. So I'd like to think we're friends. All of us at the library, but you and I most of all. And you looking this sad every day is just about breaking my heart.
If they had been anywhere else, Alice might have smiled. It was quite an admission from Marjorie, after all. But something had closed over these last months, and she didn't seem to feel things in the way she used to.
You want to get a drink? Marjorie said finally.
You don't drink?
Well, I won't tell no one if you don't.
She held out an arm, and after a moment, Alice took it, and they headed out of the department store toward the nearest bar.
Bennett and I,
Alice said, over the noise of the music and the two men yelling at each other in the corner.
We have nothing in common. We don't understand each other. We don't talk to each other. We don't seem to make each other laugh, or long for each other, or count the hours when we're apart.
Sounds like marriage from where I'm sitting, Marjorie observed.
And of course, there is the other thing.
Alice looked awkward even saying the words.
Still?
Well, now that is a problem.
Marjorie recalled the comfort of Sven's body wrapped around hers just that morning. She felt stupid now for how afraid she'd been, asking him to stay, trembling like one of Fred's spooked thoroughbreds. McCullough hadn't shown up. Sounded like he had been so drunk he couldn't hit the ground with his hat, Sven pointed out. He most likely wouldn't even remember what he'd done.
I read that book, the one you recommended.
You did?
But it only seemed to make things worse.
Alice threw her hands up.
Oh, what is there to say? I hate being married. I hate living in that house. I'm not sure which of us is more miserable, but he's all I have. I'm not going to have a baby, which might have made everyone happier because, well, you know why. And I'm not even sure I want one, because then I wouldn't be able to ride out anymore, which is the only thing that brings me any happiness at all. So I'm trapped.
Marjorie frowned.
You're not trapped.
Easy for you to say. You have a house. You know how to get by on your own.
You don't have to play by their rules, Alice. You don't have to play by anyone's rules. Hell, if you wanted, you could pack up today and head home to Ingerland.
I can't.
Alice reached into her bag and pulled out the letter.
Well, hello there, pretty ladies.
A man in a wide-shouldered suit, his mustache slick with wax, his eyes wrinkling with practiced bonhomie, planted himself against the bar plumb between the two of them.
You looked so deep in conversation, I almost didn't want to disturb you. But then I thought, Henry boy, those pretty ladies look like they could do with a drink. And I could not forgive myself if I let you sit there thirsty. So, what'll it be, huh?
He slid an arm around Alice's shoulders, his eyes flickering over her chest.
Let me guess your name, beautiful. It's one of my skills, one of my many special skills. Mary Beth. You look pretty enough to be a Mary Beth, am I right?
Alice stuttered a no. Marjorie stared at the 2 short inches between his fingers and Alice's breast, the proprietorial nature of his grip.
No, that don't do you justice. Laura. No, Loretta. I once knew a very beautiful girl called Loretta. That must be it.
He leaned in to Alice, who turned her head, her smile uncertain, as if she didn't want to offend him.
You gonna tell me I'm right? I'm right, ain't I?
Actually, I...
Henry, is it?
Said Marjorie.
Yes, it is. And you would be a... Let me guess.
Henry, can I tell you something?
Marjorie smiled sweetly.
You can tell me anything, darling.
He raised an eyebrow, his smile knowing.
Anything you like.
Marjorie leaned forward so that she was whispering in his ear.
The hand that's in my pocket. It's resting on my gun, and if you don't take your hands off my friend here by the time I'm done talking, I'm gonna close my fingers around the trigger and blow your oily head halfway across this bar.
She smiled sweetly, and then moved her lips closer to his ear.
And Henry, I'm a real good shot.
The man stumbled over the feet of the stool she was sitting on. He didn't say a word, but walked briskly back to the other end of the bar, shooting glances behind him as he went.
"Oh, and it's real kind of you, but we're just fine for drinks,"
Marjorie called more loudly.
"Thank you, though."
"Whoa," said Alice, adjusting her blouse as she watched him go. "What did you say to him?"
"Just that, kind as his offer was, I didn't think it was gentlemanly to lay his hands on a lady without an invitation."
"That's a very good way of putting it," said Alice. "I can never think of the right words to say when I need them."
"Yeah, well,"
Marjorie took a slug of her drink.
"I've had some practice lately."
They sat for a moment and let the bar chatter rise and fall around them. Marjorie asked the bartender for another bourbon, then changed her mind and canceled it.
"Go on," she said, "with what you were saying."
"Oh, just that I can't go home. That's what the letter said. My parents don't want me back."
"What? But why? You're their only daughter."
"I don't fit. I've always been something of an embarrassment to them. It's like, I don't know, how things look is more important to them than anything else. It's like we speak different languages. I honestly thought Bennett was the one person who just liked me as I was."
She sighed.
"And now I'm trapped."
They sat in silence for a moment. Henry was leaving, casting furious, anxious glances at them as he hauled at the door.
"I'm going to tell you one thing, Alice," said Marjorie as the door closed behind him.
She took Alice's arm and gripped it, uncharacteristically tightly.
"There is always a way out of a situation. Might be ugly, might leave you feeling like the earth has gone and shifted under your feet. But you are never trapped, Alice. You hear me? There is always a way around."
"I don't believe it."
"What?"
Bennett was examining the creases in his new trousers. Mr. Van Cleve, who had been standing with his arms outstretched, being pinned for a new waistcoat, gestured abruptly toward the door, so that a pin caught him in his armpit and made him curse.
"God damn it! Out there, Bennett!"
Bennett looked up and through the tailor's shop window. To his astonishment, there was Alice, arm in arm with Marjorie O'Hare, walking out of Todd's Bar, a spit and sawdust establishment that advertised Buckeye Beer on Sale Here on a rusty sign outside the door. They had their heads tilted together and were laughing fit to bust.
"O'Hare," said Van Cleve, shaking his head.
"She said she wanted to do some shopping, Pop," Bennett said wearily.
"Does that look like Christmas shopping to you? She's being corrupted by the O'Hare girl. Didn't I tell you she was made of the same stuff as her no-good daddy? Goodness knows what she's encouraging Alice to get up to. Take the pins out, Arthur. We'll fetch her home."
"No," said Bennett.
Van Cleve's head swiveled.
"What? Your wife's been drinking in a goddamn honky-tonk. You have to start taking control of the situation, son. Just leave her. Has that girl ripped the damn balls off you?"
Van Cleve bellowed into the silent shop. Bennett flashed a look at the tailor, whose expression betrayed the kind of nothing that would later be discussed feverishly among his colleagues afterward.
"I'll talk to her. Let's just go home. That girl is causing chaos. You think it does this family standing any good for her to be dragging your wife into a low-life bar? She needs sorting out, and if you won't do it, Bennett, I will."
Alice lay on the daybed in the dressing room, staring up at the ceiling as Annie prepared the evening meal downstairs. She had long since given up offering to help, as whatever she had done, peeling, chopping, frying, had been met with barely concealed disapproval, and she was weary of Annie's sly comments. Alice no longer cared that Annie knew she was sleeping in the dressing room and had no doubt told half of Baileyville, too. She no longer cared that it was obvious she still had her monthlies. What was the point in trying to pretend? Outside the library, there were few people she cared about impressing anyway. She heard the sound of the men returning, the exuberant roar of Mr. Van Cleve's Ford as it ground to a halt in the gravel drive, the slamming of the screen door that he plainly felt unable to close quietly, and she let out a quiet sigh. She closed her eyes for a moment. Then she raised herself and walked into the bathroom, ready to make herself look nice for the evening meal. They were already seated when Alice came downstairs, the two men opposite each other at the dining table, their plates and cutlery laid neatly in front of them. Small bursts of steam escaped through the swinging door, and inside the kitchen, Annie's clattering pan lids suggested the imminence of food. Both men looked up as Alice entered the room, and the thought occurred to her that it might be because she had made a little extra effort. She was wearing the same dress she had worn when Bennett had proposed to her, her hair neatly brushed and pinned back. But their expressions were unfriendly.
Is it true?
Is what true?
Her mind raced with all the things she might have got wrong today. Drinking in bars, talking to strange men, discussing the married love book with Marjorie O'Hare, writing to her mother to ask if she might come home.
Where is Miss Christina?
She blinked.
Miss who?
Miss Christina!
She looked at Bennett, and back again at his father.
I have no idea what you are talking about.
Mr. Van Cleve shook his head, as if she were mentally deficient.
Miss Christina and Miss Evangeline, my wife's dolls. Annie says they're missing.
Alice relaxed. She pulled out a seat, as nobody else was going to, and sat down at the table.
Oh, those. I took them.
What do you mean you took them? Where'd you take them?
There are two sweet little girls on my rounds who lost their mother not long back. They didn't have any gifts coming at Christmas, and I knew that passing them on would make them happier than you can imagine.
Passing them on?
Van Cleve's eyes bulged.
You gave away my dolls to hillbillies?
Alice laid the napkin neatly on her lap. She glanced at Bennett, who was staring at his plate.
Only two. I didn't think anyone would mind. They were just sitting there doing nothing, and there are plenty of dolls left. I didn't think you'd even notice, to be honest.
She tried to raise a smile.
You are grown men, after all.
They were Dolores's dolls. My darling Dolores. She'd had Miss Christina since she was a child.
Then I'm sorry. I really didn't think it would matter.
What has gotten into you, Alice?
Alice let her gaze fix on a point of the tablecloth just past her spoon. Her voice, when it emerged, was tight.
I was being charitable, like you always tell me Mrs. Van Cleve was. What were you going to do with two dolls, Mr. Van Cleve? You're a man. You don't care about dolls any more than you care about half the trinkets in this place. They're dead things. Meaningless.
They were heirlooms. They were for Bennett's children.
Her mouth opened before she could stop it.
Well, Bennett isn't having any children, is he?
She looked up and saw Annie in the doorway, her eyes wide with delight at this turn of events.
What did you just say?
Bennett isn't going to have any wretched children because we are not involved in that way.
If you're not involved in that way, girl, it's because of your disgusting notions.
I beg your pardon.
Annie began to put the plates down. Her ears had gone quite pink. Van Cleve leaned forward over the table, his jaw jutting.
Bennett told me. Pa?
Bennett's voice held a warning.
Oh, yes, he's told me about your filthy book and the depraved things you tried to do to him.
Annie's plate dropped in front of Alice with a clatter. She skittered back to the kitchen. Alice blanched. She turned to look at Bennett.
You talk to your father about what goes on in our bed.
Bennett rubbed at his cheek.
I didn't know what to do, Alice. You kind of shocked me.
Mr. Van Cleve threw his chair back from the table and stomped round to where Alice was sitting. She flinched involuntarily as he towered over her, spraying saliva as he spoke.
Oh, yes, I know all about that book and your so-called library. You know that book has been banned in this country? That's how degraded it is.
Yes, and I know that a federal judge overturned that same ban. I know just as much as you do, Mr. Van Cleve. I read the facts.
You are a snake. You have been corrupted by Marjorie O'Hare, and now you are trying to corrupt my son.
I was trying to be a wife to him, and there's more to being a wife than arranging dolls and stupid china birds.
Annie peered around the doorway with the last plate, immobile.
Don't you dare criticize my Dolores's precious things, you ungrateful wretch! You aren't fit to touch the heel of that woman's shoes! And tomorrow morning, you're going to go up those mountains and fetch my dolls back!
I will not! I'm not taking those dolls away from two motherless children!
Van Cleve raised a stubby finger and jabbed it at her face.
Then you're banned from that damned library from now on, you hear me?
No.
She didn't blink.
What do you mean, no?
I told you before, I'm a grown woman. You don't get to ban me from anything.
Afterward, she remembered thinking distantly that old man Van Cleve's face had grown so crimson that she feared his heart might give out. But instead, he lifted his arm, and before she realized what was happening, a white-hot pain exploded at the side of her head, and she collapsed against the table, her knees buckling under her. Everything went black. Her hands gripped the tablecloth, the plates collapsing toward her as her fingers closed around the white damask, pulling it down until her knees hit the floor.
Pa! I'm doing what you should have done a long time ago, knocking some sense into this wife of yours!
Van Cleve roared, his fat fist banging down on the tablecloth so that everything in the room seemed to shudder. Then, before she could gather her thoughts, her hair was pulled back sharply, and another blow, this time her temple, so that her head bounced off the edge of the table. And as the room spun, she was dimly aware of movement, shouting, the clatter of plates hitting the floor. Alice lifted an arm, tried to shield herself, braced for the next. But from the corner of her eye, she glimpsed Bennett in front of his father, an exchange of voices she could barely make out over the ringing in her ears. She climbed heavily to her feet, pain clouding her thoughts, and staggered. As the room bucked around her, she was dimly aware of Annie's shocked face at the kitchen door. The taste of iron flooded the back of her throat. She heard distant shouting, Bennett's,
"No! No, Pa!"
Alice realized that her napkin was still balled in her fist. She looked down. It was spattered with blood. She stared at it, blinking, trying to register what she was seeing. She straightened up, took a moment for the room to stop spinning, then placed it, neatly, on the table. And then, without stopping to pick up her coat, Alice walked unsteadily past the two men into the hallway, opened the front door, and continued walking all the way up the snow-covered drive. An hour and 25 minutes later, Marjorie opened the door a crack, her eyes narrowed in the dark, and found not McCullough or one of his clan, but the thin figure of Alice Van Cleve, shivering in a pale blue dress, her stockings ripped and her shoes crusted with snow. Her teeth chattered and the side of her head was bloodied, her left eye pursed into a livid purple bruise. Blood leached rust and scarlet into the neckline of her dress, and what looked like gravy spattered her lap. They stared at each other as Bluey barked furiously at the window. Alice's voice, when it came, was thick, as though her tongue was swollen.
"You said we were friends."
Marjorie uncocked her rifle and placed it against the doorframe. She opened the door and took her friend's elbow.
"Come on in. You come on in."
She glanced around at the darkened mountainside, then closed and bolted the door behind her. Chapter 12.